This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Diamonds are forever, or so we thought. Turns out that global sales of diamonds and other fine jewelry have been sluggish since the 2008 recession and slid even further downward last year. Bijoli Shah blames our growing enchantment with technology. Today, parents are more likely to buy their kids a computer than earrings or choose less pricey jewelry online. Bijoli is a journalist, but she comes from a family of jewelers and wrote for Pacific Standard Magazine about how technology may be killing one of the world's oldest trades, the jewelry business. Bijoli, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So a little bit about your family. How long has it been in the business?
My dad's been a jeweler since 1982, so, God, that's math that I can barely do, but over 30 years at this point.
So when did this luxury jewelry trend actually start? When did it become big here in the U.S.?
So it actually started, and I was surprised to learn this, too. This was news to me that I found out while researching, but it actually started back in the baby boomer generation, and as a sign of status, you know, these war vets would come home from the war, and they would proposed. They would get married, they would buy jewelry, and really the big significant piece to signify this commitment was always this big engagement ring. And, you know, from there spawned the smaller cottage industries of earrings for an anniversary, bracelets, necklaces, before you build up to the engagement ring.
So those days seem to be over. You write in your article about how millennials are much more inclined to buy something functional. So is it the idea that we're valuing performance over these old heirlooms aesthetics?
Sure. I think that there are a lot of different factors that contribute. And I spoke to about 100 people that were both in the millennial range, but also in their early to mid-30s about this. And they all kept sort of saying variations of the same thing, which was that jewelry just wasn't as functional. And a few of them said that, you know, it signified more of a commitment than they were willing to make, even if they were willing to spend the exact same price for a different object. And it kept coming back to those two things. It was either it signified too much commitment, or it, you know, for the same price, you could get an iPad that you'd get tons of mileage out of, or a TV, or, you know, something of the like.
How about the idea of jewelry as an investment, however, as something that's going to stay around and be worth money for a long time?
I have two different points of view on that. If you talk to my dad, who's been a jeweler forever and would love for you to believe in that, he'll be the first person to tell you that jewelry is one of the things that depreciates at a very significant rate, much closer to cars, actually, than you'd even think, even though you can keep a stone in the family and pass it down as an heirloom. And the second thing for millennials, from people I've talked to, that's not even a thing that really comes up in conversation. I don't know if the jewelry industry is doing bad branding. Actually, I can tell you they definitely are doing bad branding. They haven't innovated the way that they've marketed to people. So not a single one of my friends would tell you that, hey, jewelry is an investment. This diamond will stay in my family for generations, even though that is, of course, very true.
So, sure. But if you think about, you know, a Chanel bag or a Patek watch or a, you know, a honking big diamond is a social statement. It's something that says to the world, I've made it. It's not as if carrying around an iPad says the same thing.
No, absolutely. And I think that there are a couple of things that play in there. Sure, if you have tons of money and can afford the statement, then I don't think your jewelry buying has dropped significantly. But I think for millennials, even affluent millennials who are making, say, about $100,000 a year, there isn't the same amount of money to spend on both the social statement and something functional. So people tend to, it's not an exact one-to-one displacement, but people are definitely spending, choosing to spend their dollars, I suppose I should say, on these products that are more functional, you know, by and large, in these, like, in these groups of millennials or in people that just don't have the purchasing power to buy, you know, both things in the same calendar year.
There are other things besides the idea of getting things that are functional, however, that have influenced this. I mean, the idea of conflict diamonds and avoiding buying conflict diamonds and gold jewelry. Now that we know how earth intensive gold mining is, do you think people have turned away for other reasons?
Yeah, of course, there are social causes. You know, we all saw Blood Diamond. It's something that we talk about and we think about. But I think that there are two bigger issues since it isn't exactly a one-to-one displacement of dollars. One is the barrier to entry for the jewelry industry. It's a little complicated. You're talking about carats and cut and color and clarity. And, you know, you have other industries that are usually a little hard to understand, eyeglass buying, for example. But you have companies like Warby Parker that came in and simplified the entire process in ways that people really have it in jewelry. And the second thing is that there are just so many more things to buy. You know, like the jewelry industry really started burgeoning in the 50s and carried onwards. You know, baby boomers came home and they were buying rings. But nowadays, there are lots of great things to spend $500 to $600 on. Back in the 70s, 80s, even the early 90s, it's not that there weren't tons of things to buy, but at that price point, there were far fewer, you know,
luxury items. Now we have so many. We have purses, we have watches, we have, you know, cashmere sweaters, whatever.
Yes, exactly. The definition of luxury has just expanded, I think, in droves in the last 10 years.
Well, you talked about Warby Parker. Now, this is the eyeglass service. Well, they'll send you four different styles at home. You can try on all of them, send them back. Obviously, you know, no one's going to send you four expensive diamonds through the mail. But what is the difference in buying something online or from a jewelry store?
I think that when you go online and from a jewelry store, the best thing, especially about jewelry, is that it's so customizable. So I love Warby Parker. I use them all the time, even though my eyesight's pretty good. But for the most part, the only thing that's customizable is my individual prescription. But for a jewelry store, I think that you go into a store and you get to talk to a jeweler and you get to say, you know, this is my budget. What's the best ring I can make? And a good independent jeweler can advise you on, you know, you can sacrifice a little here in color, but I wouldn't lose that same value on cut. You know, you can lose a little on carat, but clarity is important. So on and so forth. And I think that that's a really hard thing to move online. It's also just such an expensive piece that you're investing in that I know all about how Apple products work. And I have 100 friends I can ask and a million product reviews. And the product is always going to be the same out of the box. But no two diamonds are ever the same, even if they're both certified at the exact same cut, color, clarity, carat. You know, you need to see it and feel it and hold it. And I don't think that we live in a see it, feel it, hold it, go to a brick and mortar type of society anymore.
Right. It doesn't sound like good news for mom and pop jewelry stores out there.
No.
But I'm thinking about the global markets. I mean, India, China, you know, places with a growing middle, upper middle class luxury market and a strong tradition in India, especially of jewelry.
Yeah. Those markets are also being squeezed. Buying is down in the gold, silver, and diamond categories. And, they're, you know, you have De Beers now saying that the entire industry buying is down because even in those global markets, China, India, the status sign kind of is for people that can now afford it, hey, look, I can buy an iPhone. So, yes, jewelry is an important tradition, and I don't see people choosing to expand on the tradition unless they really have the disposable income to do both. You know, buy jewelry and keep up with the changing.
Well, it is award season anyway, Bijoli. Is your family at all rejoicing that all of those diamonds come out, those borrowed diamonds come out on display on the necks and ears of starlets?
It's really not even something that we talk about that often. I mean, we look at them amongst ourselves and we talk about people's, you know, different jewelry choices. But I think that award season just makes it a little bit harder for independent jewelers to do well because it just doesn't trickle down. You know, you see Natalie Portman wearing $1 million earrings that for all intents and purposes look like any old stud earrings you could get at the store. And you don't see a normal person going, well, I'm going to go buy some stud earrings too now. It continues to be a foreign, out-of-reach concept.
I've also noticed, you know, among J. Crew, Club Monaco, you know, the retail stores are making pretty good-looking fakes.
Yeah, they absolutely are. And that's really one of the biggest issues, I think, is that the industry is getting squeezed by really good costume jewelry. Your finger's not turning green anymore. For $150, you can get a statement piece that maybe won't stay trendy, but at least you didn't buy a $1,000 statement piece that isn't going to stay trendy. And, you know, and it's all about perceived value. So if I wear a statement jewelry piece that, you know, I normally wouldn't invest in gold jewelry because it's not my style. If I wear a statement $100 gold chunky necklace, people still think it looks really good. Even the fakes that are meant to look like diamonds look pretty good now. So, you know, why wouldn't you mix and match at an affordable rate? I don't think many people come up to you inquiring about carat size.
Okay, Bajoli, maybe you should start encouraging your family to get into the, diamond encrusted iPhone cases.
That is definitely the industry that we should be in. Diamond encrusted wearables, diamond encrusted, anything that you can upgrade with diamonds every 2 years.
And as soon as you produce them, the size will change.
I'm sure. This industry has been set up for me to not get an inheritance from my parents down the road, but I'm slowly making peace with it.
Bajoli, thank you very much for joining us.
Awesome. It was so nice speaking to you.
Journalist Bajoli Shah wrote the article, Has Technology Killed the Jewelry Industry, for Pacific Standard Magazine. You'll find a link to read it. It's at wordofmouthradio.org.
Shine bright like a diamond. Shine bright like a diamond.
Well, forget about diamonds and pearls. The hottest gift this Valentine's Day is a ticket to see the new film adaptation of E.L. James' wildly popular erotic novel, 50 Shades of Grey. According to The Hollywood Reporter, the film is expected to take in between $45 and $50 million in North America this weekend. But just who is going to see the movie? Well, the website The Wrap called through data from Facebook to find out who is most excited about the film and in which states in the U.S. they live. And the results may surprise you. Word of Mouth senior producer Maureen McMurray caught up with The Wrap's Matt Donnelly and asked him which states made the top 10.
Sure thing. Yeah, well, it's like Mom always said, you never know who your neighbors are, right? So we actually worked in partnership with Facebook to gather data based on conversation over, you know, that particular platform. So this is based on Facebook statuses, comments, shares of images from the film, and it appears the top 10 states in the country that talk most about the film, which opens on Friday, is from least to most popular: Rhode Island, Vermont, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, New Hampshire,
New
Indiana.
Hampshire, what number are we on the list?
We're number 6, which is a nice place in the middle, I think.
And who's number 5?
The top 5 is Indiana, Maine, Ohio, Michigan, and number 1, which actually genuinely surprised all of us, is West Virginia.
And why did you find that surprising?
I don't know. I mean, well, number 1, Virginia is supposed to be the one for lovers, not West Virginia. And I just feel like, you know, it's such a, you know, it's more of a blue-collar state, and there's such mixed politics there. I was just very, very surprised. I thought that definitely a coastal city might come in number 1, but maybe that's just my own stereotyping. This list has certainly corrected my thinking.
Also, there are quite a few New England states on that list. What do you think explains that?
Yes. Well, maybe all that cold weather forces everyone inside and creative things to do when you're there.
And are you surprised? I mean, you're calling us from Los Angeles, that California didn't make the top 10?
I'm horrified. It's my home. It's my hometown. It's my home state. And I'm horrified that we come in last. You know, it also just teaches you not to buy into stereotypes that, you know, this is the land of milk and honey. There are a lot of conservative people here, apparently.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for talking to us. And I think New Hampshire can be very proud that we broke into the top 10.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You guys have always been progressive, so you should keep up that tradition, and I hope everyone enjoys the movie.
Swing state indeed.
I put a spell on you.
Matt Donnelly there from The Wrap, talking about the 10 states most excited about the 50 Shades of Grey movie, which opens in theaters this Friday. If you'd like to read an interesting joint review of the film, Matt attended a screening with a professional dominatrix. You'll find a link to read that review on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
I tell you, I ain't lying.
Stay with us as we trade in the blindfolds and handcuffs for skimpy costumes and capes and corsets. After the break, we'll get an inside look at sexism and women's empowerment in the comic book movie and comic book industry. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
I put a spell on you.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Just a few weeks ago, the writer and director Joss Whedon, the mastermind behind Buffy the Vampire Slayer, The Avengers, and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., had some tough words for the comic book movie industry, stating, "There is genuine, recalcitrant, intractable sexism and old-fashioned misogyny that goes on. You hear, oh, female superheroes don't work because of those two bad ones that didn't work 8 years ago. There's always an excuse." Well, the battle over sexism rages off-screen and in the comic book industry itself. In our next story from producer Frances Harlow, two women tackle this issue and come to very different conclusions about male dominance in their field. Here's their story.
Bevan Lucas sits at a long folding table covered with her artwork. In one print, a scrawny, angular Batman wears only a signature mask and a Speedo. We're in a basement-level conference room filled with booths for Maine's first-ever Comic-Con. Vendors display stacks of plastic-wrapped comics. Authors give signings. Fans, mostly men, rep their Batman hoodies or X-Men shirts. Bev herself is punky-looking and pretty, with short brown hair and a septum piercing. She says that, in addition to selling some of her work, she'd like to connect with other women who read comics.
There was a woman walking around in an X-Men costume, which would have been cool, but she was wearing, like, white booty shorts, and just everything was showing. I mean, she was beautiful, and she could definitely pull it off. I respect her appreciation for the comic book, but I kind of wish she hadn't had to go to that extent to show it.
Bev's bedroom is decorated with Batman posters, action figures, and, of course, comics. And like any true fan, even her complaints are imbued with love.
When I started reading comic books, I saw that independence, that strength of human, not the strength of man. And so I'm still looking for that strength and that independence and that rebellion and that fight against evil. I'm not finding it necessarily with the female comic book characters, but I want to. So I want to keep reading and see if I'll find it one day.
It isn't just the portrayal of women in comics.
When I walk into comic book stores and there's other guys around, there is that kind of double take because I'm not with a guy when I go in and I'm buying for myself. I don't know if it shocks them, but they're not expecting it.
Because the reality is, Bev's in the minority. It's an entire medium dominated by men. They write and draw the comics, which feature mostly male characters, for a largely male audience.
They thought Batman needed a woman, so they brought in Batgirl, Batwoman, Catwoman to be the love interest for Batman and Robin. You know, the hero needs someone to save. Let's bring in a woman. All of the female protagonists have these, like, triangular hourglass figures, and everything's really harsh lines, and I don't mean to be vulgar, but no one's boobs look like that.
So Bev doesn't wear a costume or a t-shirt. She's actually inked her devotion on the middle finger of her right hand, a tiny, almost unnoticeable, Batman symbol.
It was kind of a prove your love, like, I'm going to have this for the rest of my life. You're a man and you read comic books, and I'm a woman and I read comic books, and I'm going to show it on my body. Like, suck it.
But not all women feel that way.
I feel so comfortable at conventions because I feel like this is where I belong.
It's like Disneyland or Disney World. Being one of those princesses or something that little girls dreamed of being. I dreamed of being a superhero.
Back at Comic-Con, I caught up with the woman in the white booty shorts. Her name's Nicole Jean, but today she's Emma Frost from X-Men. Nikki's tall, blonde, and tan. She's also a cosplayer, someone who attends events dressed as a fictional character. And as unrealistically drawn as comic book characters are, she looks like one come to life.
Emma Frost, she wears white. She's the white queen. She likes to dress sexy, so I'm wearing a corset and very short shorts and a cape. She always has a cape. And, of course, the X symbol.
In costume, Nikki's like a celebrity. People often ask to have their picture taken with her. And for the most part, fans love to see their favorite superheroes in the flesh and critique the minutiae of their costumes. The more accurate, the better.
I use straps so I could hold it up, because if somebody steps on my cape, everything comes down. So I put straps in that, and people were like, Emma Frost doesn't wear straps. I'm like, oh, okay, well, she's also a comic book character.
At home in her apartment, Nikki's friendly and candid. She agrees with Bev about the portrayal of women in comics, that their outfits are minuscule and designed to appeal to men. But her concerns are more logistical than intellectual.
You don't even know how they stay on. They're just basically plastered to them. It's not possible to do in real life.
Because Nikki makes her own costumes. One corner of her living room is designated workspace, with swatches of fabric, sketches, and her sewing machine. Like Bev, Nikki's inspired by comics. They provide a creative outlet she wouldn't otherwise have. Nikki says she's always been a geek, but she used to hide it because she's also so girly.
I didn't really have a lot of close girlfriends because they were playing with the Barbie dolls. I liked that, but I also wanted my Ninja Turtles to hang out with the Barbie dolls. I mean, it shouldn't be considered stuff that boys like, but growing up, girls like dolls and boys like video games and comic books. The stereotype nerdy girls is, you know, supposed to be more like tomboyish. I don't like that stereotype. I'm like, I like to be a girl. I like to be girly girl.
Cosplaying has introduced Nikki to a whole network of adoring geeks, including her boyfriend. She even has a crew consisting of Mr. T, fellow X-Man Deadpool, and Link from Zelda. But most of her fans are men, many of whom seem to appreciate her figure more than her costume. Still, Nikki says cosplay isn't about a strict resemblance.
I have seen Spider-Man and Batman of all different shapes and sizes. It's not realistic that someone is going to look like these giant steroid packed men and the women with their breasts that are larger than the rest of their body. Give people credit for putting effort into the costume and everything. They are trying to represent the character they love, and they're putting their creativity into it.
In theory, a subculture built upon decades of obscure trivia would welcome anybody who knows their stuff, which Bev and Nikki have clearly demonstrated, but they still feel like outsiders. And yet, despite taking radically different approaches, both Bev and Nikki use their bodies to show their devotion, creating a distinctly female space in an otherwise male community.
Stick around for more word of mouth. Up next, we're going to approach the time-honored Oscar snub from a different angle. Instead of focusing on films and actors who got the cold shoulder from the Academy this year, we'll reveal entire categories, notably absent from the awards. Ladies and gentlemen, nominees for the WAMI Awards, after the news.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Each year, critics and moviegoers make a show of combing through the list of Academy Award nominees to determine who got snubbed. That's all well and good and often quite entertaining. But we at Word of Mouth have been thinking for some time now that there are entire categories that get the cold shoulder from the Oscars. And it's about time we talked about them. So we asked Amy Diaz, movie reviewer and editor of The Hippo, to join us for what we are calling the WAMIs, an unauthorized celebration of achievements that go uncelebrated at the Oscars. And Amy, a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks. I feel like I should ask you who you're wearing.
I'm wearing my pajamas. I'm so glad you were game for this. It's such a fun exercise. And you were kind enough to come up with a fantastic list of categories and nominees for the WAMIs. So let's start with the award for Best Voice Acting. First of all, why does this deserve to be part of the Oscars?
Well, you know, why not? Honestly, there have been years recently where I felt like the pool of best animated films have been stronger than the pool of best films. So, you know, we recognize the actors in the best films. Why not recognize the people in the animated films? It's a slightly different kind of acting, too. You know, mm-hmm. what they're bringing to the movie, what they're bringing to the part. So I think it's worth some recognition.
So let's hear some of the nominees for Best Voice Acting.
So I had, this category is Lego Movie and Guardians of the Galaxy heavy, I'll admit. So from the Lego Movie, Chris Pratt, Will Ferrell, and Morgan Freeman. From Guardians of the Galaxy, Bradley Cooper and Vin Diesel. And then from Box Trolls, which I think is actually nominated, Elle Fanning, who played this great little girl character that was kind of a classic storybook little girl. She's, you know, adventurous, but bossy and kind of ghoulish. And I loved the character.
Well, I like that you brought up the Lego Movie, which, of course, notably did get snubbed. Let's hear a clip.
Relax, everybody. I'm here.
Batman!
What's up, babe?
Babe!
What?
Oh, sorry. Batman. This is Emmett. Emmett, this is my boyfriend, Batman.
I'm Batman.
That's your boyfriend?
Hey, babe.
What?
Let's hold hands.
Chris Pratt, Elizabeth Banks, and Will Arnett's voices there from the Lego Movie. Do you think that this category should also include CGI motion capture performances?
You know, I think that maybe deserves to be its own thing. And it could be one of those things where they do it in the years where they have it, or they could just give it to Andy Serkis every single year, and that would also work. You know, he did a great job this year in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And that was almost not even voice acting, because there wasn't a whole lot of voice in what he was doing for that role. You know, there was a little bit. So I think it definitely, it's another kind of acting. It's a thing we're going to see in movies a lot. You know, we saw it in several movies this year. So I think, why not kind of give them some praise? You know, I was listening to Fresh Air recently and heard Benedict Cumberbatch talk about what he did to play Smaug the dragon in the Hobbit movies. There's a lot that goes into it.
Well, I was also thinking of last year, Scarlett Johansson in the film Her. You know, she was this disembodied computer voice. Did a fantastic job.
She did. And, you know, those are, again, they're really important performances to the movies, but they're maybe they don't fit in the traditional, you know, actor, supporting actor kind of sections.
All right. So the next big category that you're suggesting an Oscar should be awarded for is casting. Why casting?
Well, you know, casting, or you could call it ensemble or best cast. Just, you know, when a movie gets a group of people, not just one great actor and everybody else, but, you know, a group of people who all kind of bring a little something to it. It's really magical. And, you know, there were definitely some movies this year that were great because of each of the characters, not just one great performance, but everyone brought a little something that made it the movie it was.
Okay, so what are your nominees for best casting in a motion picture?
So my picks would be Whiplash, Guardians of the Galaxy again, the Lego Movie again, The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 1, which to me is all cast. That's what makes that movie what it is.
Julianne Moore, Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Woody Harrelson. Actually scratched
my head wondering what they were doing in that film.
And here's the thing. While I was watching it, I realized I don't actually care about the main plot or the love triangle, very tepid love triangle between Jennifer Lawrence and her two male love interests. I just was delighted to watch Woody Harrelson, Natalie Dormer, all these really strong actors
on screen.
Stanley Tucci. And then my other pick, and I think this is the quintessential one for this year, was Gone Girl. Hmm. This one I thought was one where every person in this movie did a really fantastic job and brought a little something. You're never probably going to hear me say this. This is the first time I've certainly ever said this, but Tyler Perry should have been nominated for an award.
He played this kind of like money-grubbing lawyer, or let's say aggressive, famous lawyer. He was terrific.
And brought like this note of very sharp humor and was completely unexpected and was fantastic. Ben Affleck, I thought, was great because the movie kind of used not just his strengths as an actor, but all of his weaknesses to help create this character. I would totally sign up for the TV show that is just Kim Dickens and Patrick Fugit, who played the detectives investigating the crime. I would watch the show where they just investigate stuff. That was great. They were fantastic.
You don't know if she has friends. You don't know what she does all day. And you don't know your wife's blood type.
Sure, y'all are married. I maybe it's typo.
Where are her folks? New York?
Yeah.
Can they get here in time for this press conference tomorrow?
Tomorrow? I have no idea. I haven't talked to them.
You haven't called your wife's parents
yet? I mean, you can't get a signal in this building. I've been in here talking to you.
Well, call them, please, Nick, now.
Fine. Should I know my wife's blood type?
Okay, so that is Gone Girl, one of Amy's nominees for Best Casting in a Motion Picture in the WAMIs, our new awards. Okay, so Guardians of the Galaxy comes up again. Lego Movie comes up again. We actually spoke to Oscar-nominated actor John C. Reilly last week. He had a bit role in Guardians of the Galaxy. And since we had him on the phone, asked him if he thought there were any categories missing from the Oscars.
This age-old thing that, you know, actually sang about in the Oscars with Will Ferrell and Jack Black, this idea that comedy somehow should be acknowledged in some way. But, yeah, I honestly don't spend too much time thinking about awards. I'd rather think about actually doing work. But if I was the king of the Oscars, I would say absolutely a voiceover award, a cast award, and some type of acknowledgement of the comedy world.
Actor John C. Reilly there advocating for several new categories at the Oscars, and he apparently thinks very much like my guest, Amy Diaz. She is the movie reviewer and editor of The Hippo, and we're celebrating achievements that should be in the Oscars but are not. So, Amy, he brought up this age-old comedies at the Oscars problem. What do you think there?
Well, you know, and I would, first of all, I would love to watch the Oscars where he was king of the Oscars. That would be great. because he's totally right. Comedy gets no respect at all. And a successful comedy, especially if it's a successful comedy that kind of hits on different levels, you know, it's lots of people find it funny, but it also has these smart moments. That is so much harder than, you know, the dramatic story that's maybe just a biopic about someone important and you put some swelling music behind it. Some of those are really good, too. But comedy is so hard, and that it gets so little respect is unfortunate, because those are oftentimes the movies that we love.
Well, the next category for the WAMIs is Best On-Screen Duo. Now, is this a romantic pairing or any pair of performers eligible?
I think it could be any pair of performers. And, you know, I didn't include this on my list, but another great example is a Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum from 22 Jump Street. The energy of those two guys together. I mean, that was the perfect pairing. You make that movie with any two other people, I don't know that it's as fun or as silly or as kind of meta and smart as it is with those guys. They just do such a good job and have so much chemistry. So
who are your other nominees for Best Duo?
You know, I think Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike, which I guess they would be romantic for some of that movie, and then for some of that movie, highly antagonistic, and yet they still have a great chemistry, and that kind of what they're doing works together really well. Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt, who really just, for Edge of Tomorrow, which the last time I was here, I told everyone to run out and see it. Go see it again if you saw it then. It's just so much fun. And they have a really great relationship that characters do that kind of just skirts the edge of romance but doesn't completely go there. So mostly you're watching this really tough girl and this kind of wimpy guy who kind of reluctantly is made a hero. And it's a great pairing that you wouldn't expect. Oh, and then Colin Firth and Nicole Kidman in The Railway Man. And I have to admit, what I loved about them is they're age appropriate. They are two people of roughly the same age, kind of the same age as the characters they play, and they look great together. They're like normal middle-aged people. Well, you know, normal middle-aged movie star people.
Yeah, they're pretty good-looking normal people.
But for Hollywood, that's as good as it gets. It's, you know.
Let's hear just a clip from The Railway Man. This is Colin Firth and Nicole Kidman. The film is not at all represented at the Oscars this year. Never mind, in the duo category.
So, I'm going to go up as far as my leg by train, and then I'm catching the coach to Inverness and coming down the other side. What do you think?
The West Coast is extraordinarily beautiful. You might well fall in love with it.
And if I were to fall in love, what then?
Well, instead of a coach to Inverness, you might consider taking the line back to Tindrum and changing for Oban. And from there, you can get any number of boat trips. Iona, Staffa. It's very romantic. You romantic?
Oh, sounds romantic to me. Now, Amy, I'm wondering, do you not think that on-screen duo would kind of, I don't know, make the Oscars a little bit more like the MTV Movie Awards? I mean, borderline cheesy.
Sure. Absolutely. And yet, you know, it is one of those things you see, especially in romantic comedies, you can see it go wrong. So many times. It is not an easy thing to get right, to get two people who can have good chemistry, whether you're talking about romantically as like buddies, even as, you know, kind of villain and hero, you know, Whiplash. I would say that Miles Teller and J.K. Simmons, great duo, the way those two characters kind of play off of each other. Any other pair of actors, I don't know that they would have brought the same heat to that.
I'm thinking Ethan Hawke and L.R. Coltrane in Boyhood. I mean, there are scenes together.
Absolutely.
As father and son. They were just terrific. And we were also discussing back at the WAM pod, Ralph Fiennes and Zero, the character of Zero in Grand Budapest Hotel. They were,
yes,
sort of accomplices.
Again, just the way they interact brings something else to the movie.
Okay, so on to our next category, Best First Film. So what, Rookie Award?
Yeah, you know, kind of. I think that there is something to be said for praising people kind of right there at the beginning of their career. You know, somebody, one of the people that gives out awards does it as breakthrough. So you could kind of do it as not maybe the very first film. I tried to pick people where this was their first feature film. But if you maybe pick it as their first big film, then you could get someone like an Ava DuVernay, who I think Selma is her third feature film.
But
really
breakthrough,
her first breakthrough
as a director.
One. Exactly. And so, you know, my picks were Obvious Child, Gillian Robespierre. I think this was her first big feature. Dear White People, very smart, from writer-director Justin Simeon. just a really smart and funny look at kind of identity politics and how a lot of people don't fit into identity politics. And that's actually just available on streaming. So finally, you know, kind of everyone can see
it. Oh, I'm dying to see that.
It was so smart and so kind of sweet, too. And then St. Vincent, which I've often said, you know, if it weren't for the prostitutes and the strippers, it could be a family film. A very sweet film with Bill Murray. You know, he plays a very curmudgeonly guy who starts taking care of a neighbor boy reluctantly, but he needs the money. And it's sort of sweet to watch their relationship develop. Again, another example of a great duo.
All right, let's go. I'm gonna make dinner. You can do homework.
Oh, I already ate.
Stop mowing. You're mowing dirt. Let's go.
He's fed. The homework's checked. I've done my job. I'm taking a break.
Why is he mowing your dirt patch?
Oh, yeah, he's paying me hourly.
I'm showing him how the world works. You work, you get paid, you drink.
Are you drinking alcohol?
Here's one that I did not realize was not a category, and this is Best Soundtrack. I mean, don't we already have that?
Well, we have. So Best Original Song, which means it has to be a new song for that movie, which is why a lot of times you'll get musicals that have moved from the stage to the screen and they add a new song because that can be nominated, but not the songs that have been part of the musical for many years. And then there's a score. So, you know, the lovely music that swells when the king gives a speech or whatever. You know, those are categories, but there's no category that really praises the, you know, compiling of pre-existing music that sort of shines a light on when that is done really well. A really classic example is T-Bone Burnett, who put together the soundtrack for Where, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Uh-huh.
I mean, that
and
was
so many others. He's a great, great compiler.
Absolutely. And has a reputation for being able to really pull together a great mix of songs that helps to tell the story and becomes a part of the movie. You couldn't imagine that movie without those songs. They're so interlaced.
Mm-hmm. So how about for this year?
For this year, I was thinking Book of Life, which is a great little animated movie and kind of brings a Mexican folk music twist to, you know, things like there was a song by Mumford and Sons, the song Creep. Boyhood, which did a really great job of matching songs to an era.
Yeah.
And you could almost figure out, remember when it was based on the song that was playing. I think it starts out with a Coldplay song from mm-hmm. like the late 90s, early aughts.
And I remember the character, the little girl singing Britney Spears.
Exactly. And it so perfectly places it. That's when that was. Begin Again, and actually one of the songs from that movie is nominated because it was a brand new song, but music plays such a huge part throughout that movie. And then Chef, which was the Jon Favreau movie. And that movie does a great thing where it kind of gives you music connected to each of the cities where you're also seeing the food.
Mm-hmm.
So as they're making these very mouthwatering Cubanos in Miami, they're also listening to Cuban music. When they were in Louisiana, there was this great scene that had sort of a second line band version of Sexual Healing. Mm-hmm. It was just such a smart use of music. Again, you couldn't almost think of that movie without the way that they use the music.
No, and you're also talking to a big sort of cross-cultural mix there. And that's one thing it sounds like the Wammies have going for them. They are not quite as white as the Oscars.
Yay, Wammies!
Well, let's hear it for the Wammies and for Amy Diaz for playing the game. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Amy Diaz reviews films for The Hippo. She's also the editor of The Hippo. And we'd like to know what you think. Are there any categories that you find missing at the Academy Awards? Do you have suggestions for nominees that you think we let slip through the cracks? Well, we are open to hearing it. Let us know at facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And while you're there, please make your vote count for this year's WAMI Awards. We're going to announce the winners on Thursday the 19th, just before Oscar weekend.
Everyone deserves a chance to walk with everyone else.
And we're going to stay on the red carpet and revisit a film that was nominated for 5 Oscars and won 4, including Best Picture. Annie Hall's influence on the romantic comedy genre. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
And her night out on the weekend. And we can whisper things, secrets from our American dreams.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. At the 1978 Academy Awards, the film Annie Hall received 4 Oscars. Diane Keaton for Best Actress, Woody Allen for Best Director and Best Writing, and in an upset, it beat Star Wars for Best Picture. Producer Eric Molinsky considered the film's influence on other filmmakers to coincide with the 30th anniversary of Annie Hall.
Anhedonia.
That was the original title of the film.
Which I understand is a psychological state of being where one has the inability to enjoy anything.
Wendy Green Brickmont was one of the editors on Annie Hall. She says the movie was supposed to be about a guy who couldn't maintain relationships.
That's what we started out being, but everybody was enjoying Diane Keaton and the Annie Hall relationship, so that's where we ended up.
Sylvia Plath, interesting poetess whose tragic suicide was misinterpreted as romantic by the college girl mentality.
Some of her poems seem neat.
Neat?
Neat, yeah.
I hate to tell you, this is 1975, you know, the neat went out, I would say, at the turn of the century. Who are those photos on the wall?
Annie Hall ended up being a romantic comedy between Woody Allen and Diane Keaton. But the movie declared its independence from the genre in a lot of ways, and it kind of amplified the generation gap.
I think that it was very frank and new at the time, and I think that was off-putting to certain people. I mean, he just talked about things that you didn't really talk about in a forthright manner and directly to the screen, no less. And I think some people were very put off by that. I know my mother was. She came to one of the screenings. She said, "I don't like that movie." And we were all like, "What?"
The fact that he was saying, "This is what love's like in the 1970s.
Tamara Jeffers McDonald is a film professor who writes about romantic comedies.
You know, we can talk about oral sex. We can talk about mutual masturbation. We can talk about my red light bulb being the thing that I need to turn me on and you having to have marijuana to calm down in order to do it.
I don't know why you have to get high every time we make love.
It relaxes me.
Oh, you have to be artificially relaxed before we can go to bed?
Well, what's the difference anyway?
Well, I'll give you a shot of sodium pentothal. You can sleep through it.
Normally, a romantic comedy ends with the lovers getting together. If they don't, it's a tragedy. Annie Hall is a romantic comedy where the lovers don't end up together in the end, and they're each kind of okay with that. Film critic James Bowman finds that disturbing. And he thinks it's not unrelated to Woody Allen's assertion that we live in a godless universe.
Woody Allen tells us when he was a boy, he was devastated by the news that the universe was expanding. He wouldn't do his homework. I mean, what's the point? The universe is expanding.
Well, the universe is everything. And if it's expanding, someday it will break apart and that will be the end of everything.
All that is an assertion which the movie goes on to make it again and again in other ways, that it doesn't mean anything. There isn't any plan. There isn't any purpose. There isn't, therefore, any destined one for us out there. What we have to do, in the words of the doctor who brings him out of his boyish funk.
It won't be expanding for billions of years yet, Alfie. And we've got to try and enjoy ourselves while we're here, huh? Huh?
And that's the message of the film. You don't get just one and only. You don't get your destined one. But you can have a pretty good time hooking up, as we say nowadays, with whoever happens to be around.
Despite the movie's ambivalent stance on love, there's no shortage of happy-ending romantic comedies that pay homage to Annie Hall, from When Harry Met Sally to half the sitcoms that take place in New York. But one of the more interesting tributes was a little independent film that came out last year called Burning Annie.
Don't you like me?
It wouldn't work.
How would you know?
I know. I have a sixth sense.
You see dead people.
I see dead relationships.
The story is about a neurotic Jewish guy who's trying to break up with Annie Hall. The movie, not the woman. Screenwriter Zach Ordinance.
We had been watching Annie Hall constantly throughout my college career, and at some point one of my close college friends said to me, you know, we were talking about girls, and he just said, he's like, you know, I wonder if watching this movie all the time is giving us a bad attitude about dealing with girls and relationships.
The protagonist of Burning Annie is seduced by the humor and honesty of Annie Hall, but he doesn't want to end up like his Woody Allen counterpart.
It's not the most romantic comedy, you know what I mean? It doesn't exactly have a happy ending. And I think there's something sort of satisfying about the negativity of Annie Hall. You know, maybe it's just me in a way. Maybe it's part of it's just that it's refreshing to see a movie with an unhappy ending, you know, where it's done in a way that seems very realistic and credible.
At this point, Annie Hall might be a victim of its own success. The jokes have been strip-mined. And Woody Allen carries quite a bit of celebrity baggage these days. But 30 years in the future, people will probably still be watching Annie Hall. They'll need the eggs as much as we do.
I thought of that old joke, you know, the
This guy goes to a psychiatrist and says, Doc, my brother's crazy. He thinks he's a chicken. And the doctor says, well, why don't you turn him in? And the guy says, I would, but I need the eggs. Well, I guess that's pretty much now how I feel about relationships. You know, they're totally irrational and crazy and absurd. And I guess we keep going through it because most of us need the eggs.
For WNYC, I'm Eric Molinsky.
Much for your listening time. If you missed anything today, you can always catch the show in its entirety when you subscribe to the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find a link to the podcast on our website, wordofmouthradio.org, or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR and iTunes. And if you enjoy the podcast, please write a review on iTunes and tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
With help from our interns,
Fiona Shea
and Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.